And now to introduce today's speaker. We are joined by Dr. Fawn Wolf, a practicing endocrinologist with Providence Endocrinology West. Dr. Wolf earned her medical degree from Medical College of Ohio in Toledo, and then did her internship and residency with the Legacy System here in Portland and her fellowship at OHSU. Dr. Wolf is well known for her expert clinical practice in endocrinology with particular expertise in pituitary disease. She is a skilled and generous teacher, heavily involved in the training of our internal medicine residents here at Providence St. Vincent, and she's also a frequently invited speaker. We are so delighted to have Dr. Wolf join us today. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Leitcher. Thanks, everybody who came in person today. All right, so I'm going to be talking about testosterone. And we're going to be talking about what I would call pathological hypogonadism or clear-cut cases, and then late-onset hypogonadism, or rather not-so-clear-cut cases. We're going to think about how testosterone relates to health outcomes, how it changes with age, the potential benefits and risks of testosterone replacement in this group in particular, and then we'll go through the nuts and bolts of hypogonadism evaluation and testosterone replacement. So a quick review here of the anatomy and physiology. Of course, we've got the hypothalamus releasing gonadotropin releasing hormone, which stimulates the anterior pituitary to release LH and FSH, the gonadotropins, which then direct the testicles to make testosterone. And I realize this is a very confusing picture because that picture of the pituitary to me sort of looks like testicles, which is very confusing in this particular slide. But that is the pituitary in the middle, testicle at the bottom. All right, testosterone really acts as three hormones. Testosterone itself is involved in muscle mass production, and then it's converted by 5-alpha reductase to dihydrotestosterone, which is involved in secondary sex hair and the prostate, and so it's related to meds treating those conditions. And then finally, it's aromatized to estradiol, where it plays an important role with bone density. All right, so we're going to have two quick cases in the beginning with, again, what we call that those clear-cut cases, pathological hypogonadism. 36-year-old white man meets with a new primary care doctor, hasn't had insurance for 10 years, or for a number of years. He notes 10 years of fatigue, drop in libido, stamina, poor loss of beard growth. He's been healthy, he had a normal puberty. He fathered two children who are now in their teenage years. On exam, he appears much younger than stated age. He's had a loss of secondary sex hair, low muscle mass. He's pale, he has slightly small testes. His total testosterone is unequivocally low, and yes, this is the usual reference range that you're used to seeing, with the lower limit being, you know, around 250 or so. That's clearly low. FSH is low, and the rest of his biochemical evaluation is normal. His prolactin's normal. He does have mild central hypothyroidism and growth hormone deficiency as well as a mild anemia, and he has osteopenia and bone density. So on MRI, so this is central hypogonadism. On MRI, he's got a 5.9 centimeter partially cystic cellar mass. He has surgery and the pathology shows a craniopharyngioma. Post-op, he's got persistent panhypopit as well as the development of adrenal insufficiency. He started on replacement hormones and in 6 months, he, quote, feels like a new man. So here he is, as he looked when I met him, and I know this picture looks like it's from the 1970s, but I swear this was a recent picture. We just had to zoom in quite a bit. And this is how he looked when I met him. And then here he is on testosterone a couple years later. So you can see he's definitely filled out and the clear beard growth there. Second, again, clear-cut case, pathological cause before we move into the more gray zone. 32-year-old Hispanic man referred to as primary for severe hypogonadism. He complains of a lack of libido, lack of stamina and muscle, never able to grow a beard. He's been healthy with no real diagnoses, although he notes that he feels he had an incomplete puberty. His voice never changed. He'd never developed secondary sex hair. His wife's not been able to conceive, and his evaluation shows oligospermia. He appears much younger than stated age and with prepubescent testes, no secondary sex hair. His total testosterone is also clearly low with an elevated FSH this time. So this is primary hypogonadism. As such, he has a karyotype which reveals XXY. He has Klinefelter's. He goes on testosterone and 6 months later also feels like, quote, a new man. So here he is again, as he looked when I met him, 32 years old, prior to therapy. And here he is a couple of years later on testosterone. Again, you can tell he's clearly filled out. He has acne. Now he's got a beard. The other interesting thing, I think, if you look at the hairline, when you first look at the hairline of the person on the left, you wouldn't necessarily pick up on it, but that's really the hairline of a boy, a young boy, right? And then on the right, he's got just the mildest of temporal recession, which is from the testosterone. So I always say that I'm certainly to contribute to his acne and his hairline, but I take no role with his new earring or his neck tattoo that has also suddenly appeared. That was not me. Okay, so causes of pathological hypogonadism. Primary, we're thinking this is a testicular problem, so high gonadotropins, Klinefelters, or some type of testicular insult, whether it's infectious, traumatic, chemo, radiation. Secondary causes of hypogonadism, we're thinking central, so low or inappropriately low FSH and LH. Kallmann's is one genetic cause, but there's many others. More commonly, what I see are going to be the pituitary adenomas or craniopharyngiomas. We also see this from an iatrogenic source, either surgery or radiation. And then there's finally a number of infiltrative processes that can cause central hypogonadism. And this is not a complete list. So the benefits of testosterone replacement in men with these conditions with pathological severe hypogonadism is very clear, and the risks are quite limited. They have normal virilization, improvement in libido and energy, marked improvement in muscle strength and muscle mass, significant improvement in bone density. So you can see the first year, this is an older study, but the first year showing an improvement of 39% in their bone density, which was maintained in the normal range then after 2 years of therapy. However, mood and cognition data, the outcomes are mixed, even in this population. So those cases are fascinating. They're rewarding to treat, but they're certainly not the majority of the cases that you're going to see. They're not even the majority of the cases that I see when people ask about their testosterone levels. So what about these three guys? A 52-year-old man with a BMI of 34. He's tired. He's having trouble losing weight. He's got low sex drive. His total testosterone is 255. Or a 46-year-old asymptomatic man with diabetes that's not well controlled. He wants to go on testosterone to improve his glucose control. His total testosterone is 240. Or lastly, a 68-year-old healthy man who's exercising regularly, notes some decline in libido and endurance. His total testosterone is 280. So we'll think about these men as we go through the slides, and then we'll get back to them at the end of the talk. So this leads us to ask, well, how do we interpret low testosterone levels in older but healthier men, chronically ill men, acutely ill men, or maybe just men who aren't as virile as they were in their 20s and who are listening to way too many radio ads? We know that testosterone is independently reduced by a number of factors. Basically, anything that negatively impacts your health can lower your testosterone level. So diabetes, obesity, polypharmacy, chronic diseases, cancer, acute illness as well. So I would strongly discourage you from checking testosterone in the hospital unless you think that's actually part of why they're there, an integral part of why they're there, such as like an undiagnosed Klinefelter's or Kallmann's. And then we also see low testosterone with a number of chronic medication use, opioids, glucocorticoids, and anabolic steroid use. And so really in the absence of a pathological cause of hypogonadism, testosterone ends up being somewhat of a marker for general health. Now, some of those factors are modifiable, of course, and some aren't. So we're not going to look at them each individually, but just looking at weight, for example, this is a study that summarized other studies assessing effects of weight loss on testosterone levels. And so the diameter of the circle there correlates with the number of participants in that individual study. And so you can see there a linear relationship between the amount of body weight loss and then the rise in testosterone. So the y-axis is total testosterone increase. So testosterone goes down with many chronic conditions. We also know that testosterone goes down with age, and we have a number of longitudinal studies showing this, as well as cross-sectional data. Both the total and the free testosterone decline, however, drops in free testosterone appear more significant related to increases in SHBG, sex hormone binding globulin, as we age. And free testosterone drops by about 1 to 2% per year. We also see that testicular volume, semen volume, and percent of normal sperm motility decrease as well. We have a number of studies also showing that low testosterone correlates with increased mortality rates. So this was just one example of such studies, a nested case control study based on 11,000 men in their 40s through 70s. They were surveyed in the 90s and then again in 2003. They excluded those with severe obvious illness at presentation, severe baseline cardiovascular disease and cancer. And what they saw was that endogenous testosterone was inversely related to mortality, all-cause cardiovascular and cancer mortality. And in fact, those in the 25th to 30th percentile, those in the lowest quartile of testosterone had the highest risk of mortality. Those with the highest testosterone had a 25 to 30% lower risk of mortality. We also see that low testosterone is predictive of poor health outcomes beyond mortality. Numerous studies have shown that men in the lowest quartile of testosterone have sexual dysfunction, decreases in muscle mass and strength, decrease in bone density, and an increase in fractures, anemia. And so the question always rises, well, is this normal aging? Is this a normal response to chronic illness? Or do a subset of these men meet criteria for some form of pathology? This is one study that I like because I think it tries to help frame this conversation. This was the result of the European Male Aging Study. It was cross-sectional data from this study on close to 3,000 community-dwelling men, again in their 40s to 70s, and they sought to see objective evidence of androgen deficiency, both based on biochemical and objective end organ outcomes. They defined late onset hypogonadism, or hypogonadism due to nothing other than aging alone, as low testosterone. They excluded men with known pituitary testicular diseases or those on suspicious meds, so like the chronic opioids, chronic glucocorticoids. And then they defined it as either a moderate in the 230 to 317 range or more severe, less than 230 range for total testosterone. They also had to have sexual complaints as these are prominent with hypogonadism. And when they used these criteria, 2% of those community-dwelling men met this diagnosis. And then what they did is they looked at objectives or target outcomes that we know are related to hypogonadism. So they looked at hemoglobin, bone density, mean upper arm circumference, waist circumference, HOMA-IR, which is a measure of insulin resistance, and then physical performance. And you can see the black square there is the more severe group, the unfilled square is the more moderate group. You can clearly see that the hemoglobin levels were lower with lower testosterone levels, bone density was lower, upper arm circumference, and insulin resistance was worse in the most severely hypogonadal men. So in this time period in the 2000s to early 2010s, we had a number of smaller studies trying to assess the potential benefits versus risks of testosterone replacement in this group specifically. They weren't large studies, they weren't very well powered, they weren't very consistent with their exclusion and inclusion criteria. And so in 2016, we had the publication of the testosterone trials, the T trials, in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this was the first largest, I would say, robust study trying to look at these benefits versus risks. So 790 men, age 65 and older, total testosterone less than 275 on two separate occasions. Only 14% of men who initially inquired qualified. And then they had to have one or more symptoms qualifying them for one of the arms of the study. There was multiple arms in this study, which we'll look at. Like most of these studies, they were excluded if they had known pituitary testicular disease, also excluded if they had a total testosterone less than 100. And the reason for that is if your total testosterone is less than 100, this is much more likely to be some sort of pathological hypogonadism. Prostate cancer or high risk, high prostate symptom score, hemoglobin greater than 16 at baseline, MI or stroke in the last 3 months, or uncontrolled hypertension were also exclusions. And then they used a topical androgen, topical testosterone, to maintain their total testosterone levels in the 500 to 800 range for 1 year. And here again, they all had to qualify and take part in one or more of the three main trials, being physical function, sexual function, or vitality. And then they had optional participation in cognitive, bone, anemia, or the cardiovascular trials, depending on their symptoms and objective testing. Now, these men had a high rate of coexisting conditions. 62% were obese, the majority had hypertension. 14% had had prior MI, just not in the past 3 months. And so again, we're sort of looking at a mix here of age-related hypogonadism and probably some hypogonadism due to these chronic conditions. And that's the case for most of these studies. They had good retention and they had good outcomes in terms of keeping the goal testosterone in the range of 500 to 800. So to summarize what they found, they saw a modest but significant improvement in all aspects of sexual functioning, 6-minute walking distance and depressive symptoms, which correlated with testosterone levels. They saw improved hemoglobin and mild to moderate anemias were corrected regardless of their cause. And this is what we see in clinical practice as well. And they saw a significant improvement in bone density. They did not see improvement in vitality or cognitive function. And again, this is similar to prior results, except this was a larger, better run, more robust trial. The bone density in particular was quite impressive. So these were men who actually had normal bone density or maybe mild osteopenia at baseline, but you can see significant improvements in bone density. And this is actually comparable to what we see with bisphosphonates. I just have one slide on hypogonadism diabetes. We could clearly spend a full hour reviewing this data alone, but I'm going to summarize it in the interest of time. Type 2 diabetes is associated with a high prevalence of low testosterone with greater drops in total testosterone. Some of that's due to the decrease in sex hormone binding globulin that we see with metabolic syndrome. When we ask whether or not low testosterone contributes to the development of type 2 diabetes by impacting insulin resistance, we see conflicting results in the literature. But randomized controlled trials of using testosterone replacements have generally yielded either neutral or very modest benefit. So A1C reductions in the 0.1 to 0.2 range. So really nothing to write home about. And so the 2018 Endocrine Society guidelines for testosterone recommend against the use of testosterone treatment solely as a means of improving glycemic control if there are no other indications for treatment. So what about the risks of testosterone use? We think about the heart, the prostate, erythrocytosis risk, blood clots. We'll start with the heart first, and we need to start with one trial that really stands out because it scared a lot of people from using testosterone. This was the TOM trial in 2010. It's a smaller trial, 209 men, 65 and older, with limited mobility and low total testosterone. And really what they were looking at was to see whether or not testosterone replacement improved their stability, lessened their fragility. They randomized them to placebo or topical testosterone. They started at 100 milligrams per day, which is twice the usual starting dose that these studies typically use, and increased it to 150 milligrams per day if their total testosterone stayed below 500. And so a really aggressive replacement regimen. This trial was stopped early due to an increased rate of cardiovascular related adverse events, 23 in the testosterone group and 5 in the placebo group. And this is what initiated the FDA to evaluate this cardiovascular safety in testosterone. Now there's a couple of very strong criticisms here. Again, that testosterone regimen is far more aggressive than most other trials that are done and certainly more aggressive than what we utilize in clinical practice. The other criticism is that a number of the cardiovascular related adverse events were somewhat soft calls. So edema, rise in blood pressure, syncope. Some of them certainly could have been due to the high testosterone doses themselves, but some of them might not have been related. Again, we have a number of retrospective studies that we will briefly just summarize by saying most suggest either no impact or modest benefit when using testosterone. A few retrospective studies have suggested harm, though most had major methodological flaws. And so we'll now look at the prospective studies that we have. We have two prospective studies aiming to assess secondary outcome, or, excuse me, what am I trying to say? They were not powered for MACE. They were looking at surrogate markers for cardiovascular disease. So this is the TEAM trial, 300 men, 60 and older, low testosterone, randomized to testosterone gel or placebo. Primary outcome being carotid artery intermedia thickness and coronary artery calcium scores, and they saw no difference between the placebo and the testosterone arms. And then here is that cardiovascular arm of the testosterone trials that we reviewed just before. So these were 138 of those subjects. At baseline, they had high cardiovascular risk and high coronary artery calcium scores. This was not powered for MACE, and so again, a surrogate marker was assessed. The primary outcome was non-calcified coronary artery plaque volume, which was significantly greater in the testosterone group. Secondary outcomes being total coronary artery plaque volume, which was also greater. However, the coronary artery calcium scores were no different. And I still don't have a good sense for how clinically relevant the coronary artery plaque volume score is. I think you all probably know that better than I do. So just as of this summer, we finally do have a large prospective randomized controlled trial powered to assess differences in MACE between testosterone and placebo. So this is the TRAVERSE trial, 5,200 men, 45 to 80 years old, with either pre-existing or high risk for cardiovascular disease. They used a typical replacement testosterone gel, and they aimed to keep the testosterone levels in the 350 to 750 range. Primary endpoint was the first occurrence of MACE. So population here, 63 years old on average, majority Caucasian, 17% Black. Body mass index was obese. Mean total testosterone level prior to therapy was 227. And you can see just over half had pre-existing cardiovascular disease and the rest were at high risk. So this was a high-risk population. The primary endpoint, MACE, was no different between the first occurrence of MACE was no different between the testosterone group and the placebo group. Nothing reached statistical significance in terms of subgrouping other than pulmonary embolism, which was slightly higher in the testosterone group, and that is sometimes seen in other studies as well, not always. And just looking at that a little further, so again, looking at all adverse events and all serious adverse events, no differences between the testosterone and the placebo group. Non-fatal arrhythmia warranting intervention was slightly higher, reaching statistically significance in the testosterone group, and that was primarily due to increased rates of atrial fibrillation. And then one unexpected finding was that acute kidney injury was greater in the testosterone group. This has not been seen for the most part in other studies. Slight increased risk of PE and atrial fibrillation have been seen in other studies, depending on how big of a dose they're using, but the acute kidney injury was a bit of a surprise. So to summarize the cardiovascular data, what we know is that endogenous testosterone levels are inversely related to mortality, particularly cardiovascular mortality. So it's always best if you just have high testosterone levels endogenously. When we're looking at men with low testosterone levels and then giving them back testosterone, the retrospective studies are generally either neutral or slightly favorable benefit towards the testosterone. Prospective trials are limited. Most studies showed no difference other than the TOM trial, that one in 2009 or 2010, which used very high testosterone doses. And then again, just recently, our largest randomized controlled trial, which was powered for MACE, showed no increase in MACE. A couple of cautions here, though. It was of limited duration, just 2 years. So of course, the question is, well, what would happen if we continued therapy for 10 years, which is the reality for most of our patients who respond 10 years or more. The other criteria or the other caution here is that they used fairly modest dosing. So they, if you remember, these men's testosterone level started in the 220 range. They aimed to get them in the 350 to 750 range. But the reality is that the average achieved testosterone level was only, I want to say, in the high 300s. So they were not particularly aggressive with getting their testosterone levels as high as they could have. And so the question, of course, is, well, if the testosterone levels had been higher, would that have changed anything? So the US FDA still mandates a warning label for possible risk of cardiovascular events, including DVT. European Medical Agency has not found consistent evidence to make this warning. So moving on to the prostate, there's been concern about the prostate and testosterone use for a number of years. And that's, of course, because androgen receptor signaling does play a central role in prostate cancer biology. We do know that giving testosterone to men with metastatic prostate cancer is not a good thing. That makes things worse. And we also know that an androgen ablative therapy is effective against aggressive prostate cancer. So it makes sense that we would worry about giving testosterone to men, and could that cause prostate cancer or make existing prostate cancer worse? We have a number of studies showing neutral effect, but still we don't have a good randomized control trial that's been long enough or large enough to really be powered to determine whether or not testosterone increases the risk of de novo prostate cancer. But here's the data we do have. We have a couple of meta-analyses which have been generally reassuring, multinational registries again which have been reassuring for a number of different prostate outcomes. And so the recommendations at this point are really to identify men that are at high risk for prostate cancer before starting testosterone. And then the Endocrine Society recommends consideration for additional monitoring the first year of therapy. And then after the first year of therapy to use the usual recommendations for prostate monitoring. And again, though, this is just a recommendation to consider additional screening the first year. It has, I would say, probably fallen out of favor. And at this point, for the most part, for men on testosterone, we're primarily just following the usual guidelines for prostate monitoring that you would even if they weren't on testosterone. So thinking about other potential adverse effects of using testosterone in this group, well, we know that testosterone hypogonadism is associated with anemia, and that corrects upon treatment, so that's a benefit, of course. However, there is a risk of erythrocytosis, especially with the higher doses. So higher doses, we'll see erythrocytosis. And so we do screen and monitor the hematocrit when they're on therapy, and then reduce the dose if it rises to above 55, 54. There's no particular screening protocol recommended for monitoring for DVT, but it is a known risk. And so we want to be aware of the risk. DVTs generally occur if we let the testosterone level get too high, dose get too high, and their hematocrit rises excessively, or if there's an underlying thrombophilia. So I always check hematocrit before starting testosterone. I ask about personal or family history of blood clots. If the DVT is going to occur, typically it's in the first 3 to 6 months of treatment. So who do we screen for? We have all these men out here who are maybe talking about fatigue, low libido, decrease in sex drive, a lot of comorbidities with obesity, heart disease. Who do we actually screen? So there's no evidence to support population screening or testing asymptomatic patients. Again, what we're looking for is low testosterone accompanied by symptoms. So if they're asymptomatic, we don't screen. Again, I'd strongly discourage you from testing in acutely ill patients in the hospital unless you think that's integral to why they are in the hospital. And I would say that's the case for most hormones. Please don't test them in the hospital. We want to avoid testing in chronically ill men until they're medically optimized. This is a little bit, you know, of a soft call, but I mean, if you're seeing somebody with clearly uncontrolled type 2 diabetes, and we're going to want to improve the diabetes management regardless, unless you think finding low testosterone is going to be a motivating factor for them, I wouldn't necessarily check their testosterone level until you get them medically optimized, because you're not going to treat it until they're medically optimized anyway. And medically optimized obviously can differ from one person to the next, what we mean by that, and how optimal we can get their health. So what we end up with then is case detection. So we guys with signs and symptoms, low libido, with or without erectile dysfunction. The low testosterone itself primarily is driving low libido. If they really just have erectile dysfunction, but their libido is fine, generally their testosterone is going to be normal, and that's going to be more of a urologic issue. Gynecomastia, significantly reduced muscle strength and stamina. Clearly, that's subjective. And I look for clear declines in muscle strength and stamina over the last few years that don't have other obvious causes. So if they just say, well, I'm 65 now and I'm not as strong as I was when I was 25, well, that's pretty obvious. That's just going to be the way things are with aging. But if they say I'm 65 and gosh, things have really changed in the last 2 to 3 years, I don't know why, my health has been stable, that would pique my interest a bit more. Any men with fragility fractures or osteoporosis warrants a testosterone evaluation, because if they do have hypogonadism that was unknown, again, replacing the testosterone can have really profound impact on their bone density. infertility and HIV-associated weight loss. This is two groups of men that we don't have time to review in detail today, but there's a lot of data looking at these two subgroups of men. In terms of how we screen for hypogonadism, we want at least two, maybe three morning fasting samples. And the reason we want to check a couple of samples is because testosterone varies quite a bit day to day. So you could have one value that's a little bit low, and then maybe it's normal the next two times. So you don't want to make a diagnosis just based on one morning sample. You can start with the total testosterone and then include a free testosterone, either if your total comes back in sort of a borderline range, or if you have a suspicion for an altered SHBG, which we'll look at here in a moment. And then if you find hypogonadism, then you would check the FSH and LH to look for either a central or a peripheral source. There's a number of conditions that can impact sex hormone binding globulin. I've got the most common ones starred here. So if we just look at the right half of the table here first, obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome are clearly one of the more common causes that we see. We also see it with androgen and glucocorticoid use, and then other less common causes on the right there. So if we think about it, if their sex hormone binding globulin is low, their total testosterone might look low, but their free testosterone is fine. And so this is quite common in somebody with obesity or type 2 diabetes. We'll often see total testosterone levels in the mid to upper 200s or even low 200s. And then we check a free testosterone and it's fine. And so I would say that person does not have hypogonadism if they've got a clearly normal free testosterone. On the other hand, these are also conditions that truly do increase the risk of hypogonadism. So you might also find that their free testosterone is low as well, but you just need to confirm that. You can't rely on the total alone. And then on the left half of the screen, we'll see the conditions correlated with an increase in sex hormone binding globulin. So that's aging, chronic liver disease, and smoking, interestingly. And so if we think about, and then a number of others, if we think about these cases here, their total testosterone might actually look high, but their free is normal. And we'll occasionally get a referral for this combination for an older guy whose total testosterone actually reads a little high, but his free is normal. I would say that person is fine. More commonly, though, is that we might miss hypogonadism in these cases because of that increase in binding globulin. Their total might look fine, but their free is actually low. And so that's a common presentation. So additional tests, if this looks like primary hypogonadism, so a testicular source with the elevated gonadotropins, then we're going to be taking a closer testicular history and exam, considering a karyotype and ultrasound, a scrotal ultrasound. Much more commonly, it's going to be secondary hypogonadism where the FSH is either normal or low. For these cases, I would make the point that you always want to check a prolactin and ferritin, and you always want to at least consider Cushing's. So you don't have to test for Cushing's in each of these men, but you want to think about it. And the reason for the prolactin, we'll talk about a case here in a moment, but prolactinomas are very common causes of hypogonadism. And then ferritin for hemochromatosis, we uncover that not infrequently as well. And then I always get asked, well, when do you do the pituitary MRI? And it depends on how low the testosterone levels are, how old they are, the patient is, and obviously if they have any other apparent pituitary hormone deficiencies, headaches, vision changes, that's going to prompt you to get the MRI. But generally speaking, I would say in a younger guy, if their total testosterone is less than 250, that would probably trigger me to get an MRI. Older guy, less than 150. So the older you get, the lower the level has to get before it's more concerning, if that makes sense. And so just my plug here to never miss a prolactinoma. So a 48-year-old guy presents with peripheral vision loss. Chart review shows a prior diagnosis of hypogonadism. He's on testosterone replacement, but no initial evaluation was done. He's now found to have a prolactin level of 1400 and a 3-centimeter mass causing his peripheral vision loss. And truthfully, I see some version of this guy about once a year. So somebody who presents with vision loss who had known hypogonadism but never had a prolactin checked initially. And so again, the diagnosis of hypogonadism necessitates LH and FSH testing, and the non-elevated gonadotropins necessitates a ferritin and prolactin draw. Thinking about how we administer testosterone, we've got a number of formulations. There is now an oral testosterone undecanoate. I might have missed a syllable there. It's the only oral form that we have. It's fairly new. It's quite expensive. There's also subcutaneous pellets every 3 to 4 months that the urologists use. And some endocrinologists might use them as well. I just don't have any practice in that. Most commonly, though, we're using injections and topicals. So for the injections, these are going to be a shorter-acting testosterone enanthate or cypionate. Typical concentration is 200 mg per mil, although you do need to make sure that you're prescribing the concentration you think you're prescribing, because it also is available in 100 mg per mil. And the standard adult dose is going to be 1 mil or 200 milligrams every 2 weeks. Now, a lot of guys given this regimen are going to have too much in terms of peaks and valleys in their symptoms. They feel a little bit too revved up the first couple of days after the dose, and then they feel like they're definitely slumped down for a few days before their next dose is due. So if that's the case, we can move to a half dose once a week. And it's twice the number of IM injections, of course, but for guys who are having those predictable swings in symptoms, they usually prefer to go with a half dose once a week. There's also a longer acting testosterone undecanoate every 12 weeks that's administered. So I like the injections. Of course, I'm not the one having to give myself an IM injection, but I find that we see consistent absorption and I can titrate them a little bit better, I feel. The cons, of course, are the inconvenience and the pain. When you have a man on testosterone injections, you want to check the testosterone level midway between injections, particularly for the short acting testosterone, the ones that you're giving every 2 weeks or every 1 week. If you check a level the day or two after the dose is given, it's going to look high. If you check it a day or two before the next dose is due, it's going to look low. So to try to consistently monitor their results, you want to check it midway between injections. And we also have a number of topical testosterone replacements. These are now available as generics, and so they're far cheaper than they were in the past. With the gels, you have to be aware that there is some risk of transference. So what this means is the guy puts testosterone on his arm, and then if he has prolonged skin-to-skin contact with a female or a child, their serum testosterone levels can actually rise. I will say, however, it's only an issue if somebody knows that it's potentially an issue. So it's only an issue if somebody isn't aware that it could potentially be an issue. So once a guy's aware of it, it's very easy to avoid. We just have them apply it in an area that's going to be covered by clothes and avoid sexual contact for sure for 4 hours afterwards. And with the patches, it's another option, but there is some risk of skin irritation here. For both the topicals, we want to check them 3 to 6 hours after application. There's no one clear best formulation. There was a 2022 systematic review, and really there was no preference amongst patients. The topicals likely lead to more stable serum levels if compliance is high, so they're taking it the same time, the same way every day. I had said earlier that I found the injectables more consistent absorption. And by that, I mean, I get a consistent response in terms of the serum testosterone. But again, you do get those swings from week to week or day to day within the cycle. For the topicals, it's a daily administration. So you are going to get more consistent day to day. It's just that I find the serum levels aren't as predictable on the topicals. And then the injections may be associated with a higher rate of erythrocytosis. In terms of who to treat, I would say a big yes to hypogonadism due to known pituitary or testicular pathology in men of any age. So I'll see men in their 70s who just had a large pituitary adenoma removed, and their total testosterone is 15. It's clearly very low in the toilet. And they have a quite favorable risk-benefit ratio. So we'll use testosterone in those men at any age. I would say a big no to anybody who has normal testosterone levels or low testosterone levels but no symptoms. And by symptoms, I'm saying mainly sexual symptoms, normal hematocrit, normal bone density. And then, of course, there's this big yellow zone. This is the group of late onset hypogonadism, either low testosterone levels due to age or due to chronic conditions. Less than 200 to 230, depending on age and accompanied by symptoms. So my approach is that if we've optimized them medically and we don't find a reversible cause and their morning testosterone levels are consistently unequivocally low and they're symptomatic, it's reasonable to try testosterone. What the studies show us is that really only 2 to 5% of the population is going to meet this criteria. So it's not every aging man by any means. But I think it's reasonable to try testosterone because some men have a really good response. They clearly have better energy, sexual function is clearly improved. But I would say that if you try it and they have no clinical response, just go ahead and stop it within 6 months. Because what you don't want is for them to start it and then they just end up taking it the rest of their life because nobody bothered to ask them if they felt better on it and take them off of it. The other problem, of course, is that once you're on it longer than 6 to 12 months, you're going to be causing a secondary hypogonadism. So I'm sure you've probably all seen this. A guy who's been taking testosterone for a number of years, you can't just stop it cold turkey. I mean, you can, you're not going to harm them, but they're going to have significant secondary hypogonadism, much like somebody who takes prednisone for a number of months or years. And so these guidelines are consistent with most of the clinical guidelines, including those from the Endocrine Society. Okay, so going back to those earlier gentlemen, so 52-year-old man with a BMI of 32, reasonably well-controlled diabetes, he's tired, he's having trouble losing weight. He requests a prescription for testosterone, his total testosterone is 220. His free testosterone is low normal, so it's technically normal, but it's low normal. With further evaluation, you realize he probably has obstructive sleep apnea, he has stopped exercising, he's gained weight in the last few years. So I would recommend for him a sleep evaluation, resuming exercise, and his testosterone levels might increase. And of course, there's this whole chicken and egg thing. Well, you know, did he stop exercising and did he gain weight because his testosterone is low, or is testosterone low because he stopped exercising? It's a little hard to say, but if he can be successful in exercising and losing weight, his testosterone will likely come up. And obviously that is easier said than done, and not everybody's going to be successful with that. Next gentleman, 46-year-old man, asymptomatic. So there's the key word there. He's got an overweight BMI, uncontrolled diabetes. He would like some testosterone to improve his diabetes. And this just requires some education surrounding the fact that testosterone really, if it has any impact on A1C, it's quite modest. And so it should not be a reason on its own to use testosterone. Finally, 60-year-old man, healthy guy, exercises regularly. He's noted a decline in libido and endurance in the last few years, no clear causes. His total testosterone is 240. His free testosterone, however, is low. So older, slightly older guy with a probable increase in SHBG. So his total looks normal, but his free is low. He's got a mild anemia. He's got osteoporosis, but no fractures at this point. So he would be a good candidate for testosterone replacement, assuming he doesn't have any contraindications. But again, I would take the same approach where I would give it 6 months, and if he's had zero clinical impact in terms of symptoms, then we would think about, well, do we want to continue with it to see if it's going to help your bone density, or do we want to stop it because it does carry some other risks and just treat your bone density with a bisphosphonate. So to summarize, there's still considerable disagreement amongst experts due to incomplete evidence. We often see non-specific age-related symptoms and low testosterone coexisting in older men, and to some degree, we're still trying to tease out the chicken versus egg question. However, we do have good evidence that testosterone treatment in older men with low testosterone improves sexual function, improves anemia, vertebral and femoral bone density, possibly walking distance in a number of studies. We don't have good data on the durability of the effect or when to stop. So if you have, say, take for example, the last guy that I presented, the 68-year-old man who is healthy, symptomatic, low free testosterone, if he has a good clinical response to his testosterone, how long do we give it? You know, do we stop it at 75? Do we stop it at 85, 95? We don't know. So that ends up being a decision that you make individually with the patient with really not much data to go on. And again, so we have good, you know, I would say the short-term data is reassuring, long-term, still a question mark. And then lastly, again, during your evaluation, don't miss the prolactinoma cases for the central hypogonadism. And that's it. So it's a picture I took from Sobey Island just this summer at sunrise. It was a gorgeous sunrise. All right, that's all I have. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Wolf. We have a few questions online, but I'll turn it over first to the room. Anyone like to ask a question?
What's the effect of external gene radiation on prostate cancer? What is the effect on testosterone levels? You know, say 30 sessions of external gene radiation, prostate cancer.
Well, on prostate cancer or on the risk of hypogonadism?
No, on prostate cancer.
Oh, I don't
active
know.
Active biopsies, everything.
Yeah, I don't treat prostate cancer. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. I could, right. What I was thinking you were asking. So there is some risk of hypogonadism, primary hypogonadism after, you know, radiation to the pelvis for sure.
What sort of risk? 5%, 75%?
I'm sorry. I don't know those numbers. And I'm not sure if it's because I don't see those patients because there are not that many of them, or if it's because the urologist manages them themselves. They might be just managed by urology. There's a whole data set on, you know, men who have had prostate cancer, but now their PSA is undetectable. They're considered cured, and they have hypogonadism as a iatrogenic effect of their treatment and risk versus benefit of testosterone. But again, those are patients that primarily the urologists treat, and so I don't know those numbers.
Is there always an effect on the gonads, though, post-radiation?
I doubt you could say always. You know, I mean, even with, you know, any form of radiation, I mean, I'm much more familiar with the effects of radiation to the brain in terms of pituitary function, and even, you know, we can't say always. I don't see those patients. I'm sorry.
Fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. Any other questions in the room? Okay. So going to online, Dr. Wolf, there's a question. Total or free T for monitoring levels?
Oh, well, it depends on which one was abnormal to begin with. So if they're free is either proven normal or you have no reason to assume it's abnormal and you're making the diagnosis based on the total, then I would, you know, monitor the total moving forward. If they have some issue with their SHBG and their total isn't reliable and you use the free testosterone to make the initial diagnosis, then I would use that moving forward for monitoring.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Another question. So some female patients get testosterone shots from naturopaths for energy reasons. Any suggestion about how to discuss that with them?
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole other talk. I mean, we have little long-term data for using testosterone in men. We have less in women, even so. But there has been a rise in interest and studies in the last 5 to 10 years in looking at low testosterone in women and potential use of testosterone replacement. But it's primarily for sexual dysfunction. There'd certainly be no indication for use it for just generalized fatigue. It's primarily in the group of significant sexual dysfunction.
All right. Next question. So you mentioned the frequent radio ads, which we all hear.
Yes.
Do you feel that these clinics are frequently treating men that do not need treatment?
I don't know the data, but anecdotally, we inherit a lot of patients, yes, who didn't meet criteria for treatment in the beginning. But that's selection bias, so I don't know.
Great. Thank you. All right. Just a couple more. Are there any guidelines on cutoffs for using free T to determine whether someone would be a possible candidate for?
Yeah, no. And the free testosterone range varies so much lab to lab. It gets harder to talk about what a normal free testosterone level is. So I look at it at the lab that they had it drawn and just kind of look at it in terms of proportion. Are they, you know, the lowest 20%? Are they 20% below the lowest limit of normal? But no, I can't give an absolute value there.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I think last question, this is my own question. So certainly during residency, I've had a lot of young bodybuilders using anabolic steroids, usually in the setting of bodybuilding competitions.
Mm-hmm.
And they ask me about their risk of developing permanent hypogonadism. Mm. So do you, in your experience, is there any frequency or duration of anabolic steroid use that puts them at risk for irreversible hypogonadism?
Well, chronic use certainly makes the risk of persistent hypogonadism quite high. If you're using testosterone for in the range of 6 months to a year or longer, we often see hypogonadism after that. Sometimes it resolves and sometimes it doesn't. So sometimes people will take a stair-stepping down approach where they titrate the dose down and see if the endogenous production improves. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. So I think it just depends on the individual and what doses they use and for how long. In terms of like pulsatile doses, are you having some patients who use it briefly for a competition and then stop?
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. I mean, you think about like pulsatile, recurrent glucocorticoid doses, you see some risk of persistent adrenal insufficiency. So I am not sure. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you so much, Dr. Wolf. That was fantastic. Thank you.
Let's get up to clinic. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. See you later.